Chapter 24. Pitt sensed the peril before the hail of bullets struck. He threw the tri-motor into a steep 360-degree bank until he could see the Fokker moving below and to his left before it banked and returned for another attack. He shoved the throttles to their stops and followed, in the vain hope of staying on its tail. But it was a losing proposition. With three healthy engines, Pitt might have given the Fokker and its insane pilot a run for the money. The tri-motor's top speed was more than 30 miles an hour faster than the ancient fighter plane. But now, with a loss of one engine, his advantage in speed was canceled by the Fokker's agile maneuverability. Smoke poured out of the exhaust stacks of the center engine, and it was only a matter of seconds before it caught fire. He reached down between his legs and turned off the fuel selector switch, and then the ignition on a panel below the throttles, watching the propeller on the center engine come to a stop in the horizontal position. Mary's face was flushed in confusion. "He's shooting at us," she gasped. "Don't bother asking me why," Pitt fired back. Kelly appeared in the doorway of the cockpit. "Why are you throwing us all over the sky?" she demanded furiously. "You're frightening the children." Then she caught sight of the smoking engine, the shattered windshield, and felt the rush of air. "What is happening?" "We're under attack by a lunatic." "He's shooting at us with real bullets," Mary said loudly, holding up a hand and shielding her face from the onrush of air.
"But we have children on board," argued Kelly.
"He knows it and doesn't seem to care. Go back and calm the kids. Make them think we're playing a game. Urge them to sing. Do whatever it takes to occupy their minds and play down the danger." He turned his head slightly toward Mary and gave her a nod of encouragement. "Get on the radio and give a mayday. To anyone who answers, report the situation."
"Can anyone help?"
"Not in time."
"What are you going to do?"
Pitt watched as the red Fokker tri-wing swept around for another pass at the tri-motor.
"Keep everyone alive if I can."
Kelly and Mary both marveled at Pitt's unruffled calm, the grim determination that shone in his eyes. Mary began shouting a mayday into the radio microphone while Kelly ran back into the main cabin. He scanned the sky, searching for clouds to enter and lose the Fokker, but the few that floated in the sky were several miles away and a good 20,000 feet above the ground, 3,000 feet above the ceiling of the tri-motor. No clouds to hide in, no place to escape. The old transport plane was as defenseless as a lamb in a pasture stalked by a wolf. Why was the pilot he'd met earlier doing this? Pitt's brain churned with questions, but there were no simple answers. Pitt might have attempted to set the plane down in the East River. If he could make a water landing that didn't damage the airplane or injure the children, and if it floated long enough for them to escape. The thought quickly came and was rejected. With the tri-motor's rigid landing gear, the potential for a watery crash was too high, and he couldn't be sure the blood-crazed pilot of the Fokker would not strafe the helpless passengers if they weren't injured in the landing. If he intended to shoot them out of the air, Pitt thought, the guy would have no qualms about killing them in the water. Pitt made his decision and circled the tri-motor back toward the Brooklyn Bridge. The red Fokker stood on its wingtips and followed the tri-motor on a reverse course down the river. Pitt eased back on the throttles to his two remaining engines and allowed his attacker to close. Unlike modern jet fighters with missiles that could down an enemy plane from a mile away, the aces of World War I held their fire to less than 100 yards away. Pitt was counting on the Fokker's pilot to wait until the last minute to fire at the tri-motor. Like the historic days on the Western Front, the warnings of Allied pilots held true. Pitt thought of the old adage, "Watch for the Hun in the sun." It was just as relevant now as it had been then. The Fokker's pilot pulled his nose up in a steep climb, nearly hanging it on its propeller, before dipping downward in a shallow dive out of the sun. At 100 yards, the pilot opened fire as he swooped on the tri-motor, the bullets tearing into the corrugated aluminum sheets on the right wing behind the engine. But time was too short. The twin Spandaus were on target for less than 2 seconds before Pitt pushed the trimotor in a near vertical dive. The plane plunged down toward the water, the Fokker pilot right on its tail, but not firing until he could line up his sights again. Down Pitt went until it looked to the people walking along both shores, those crowded on the upper deck of an excursion boat and firemen on a passing fireboat, as if the plane would surely smash into the water. But at the last instant, Pitt pulled back on the control column and sent the trimotor on a course that would take him directly under the Brooklyn Bridge. The famous bridge loomed like a giant spiderweb with its maze of support cables. Completed in 1883, the bridge carried more than 150,000 cars a day, 2,000 bikers, and 300 pedestrians. Traffic was stopping, and people were gawking from their cars at the sight of the two old aircraft speeding toward the span. Pedestrians and bikers on the wooden walkway that was elevated over the traffic came to a halt and rushed to the railings. No one could believe the World War I fighter was actually pumping bullets into the old three-engine plane. "Oh, Lord," muttered Mary, "you're not going under the bridge." "Watch me," Pitt said doggedly. Pitt hardly took notice of the towers rising 271 feet in the air. He swiftly estimated the distance between the roadway and the water at 150 feet when it was actually 135. With smoke trailing from the center engine, the trimotor flashed under the bridge and broke out into the open, dodging a tugboat pushing a pair of barges. Thrilled at seeing the bridge pass above, the children thought it was part of the ride. Kelly instructed them to sing. Blissfully unaware of the deadly seriousness of their plight, they broke into song. "This old man, he play one, he play knick-knack on my thumb. With a knick-knack paddywhack, give the dog a bone. This old man came rolling home." The air controllers at LaGuardia, Kennedy, and the surrounding smaller airports all picked up the Mayday message sent frantically by Mary, and the police radios were alive with reports of the aerial battle. The controller at Kennedy Airport called over his chief. "I've got a Mayday from a woman in an old Ford trimotor from that air show today. She claims she's under attack by a World War I fighter plane." The chief controller laughed. "Sure, the Martians are landing at the Statue of Liberty." "There must be something to it. I'm receiving police calls saying a red triplane chased an old three-motored aircraft under the Brooklyn Bridge and smoked one of its engines." The humor quickly faded. "Do you know if the transport is carrying passengers?" "The police say it has 15 disabled children on board." He paused and his voice hesitated. I can hear them singing."
"Singing?"
The controller nodded silently. The chief controller's face took on a pained expression. He stepped over to the radar array and put his hand on the controller monitoring incoming flights.
"What do you read over Manhattan?"
"I had two aircraft over the East River, but the larger one just went off screen."
"It crashed?"
"Looks that way." The chief controller's eyes went sick. "Those poor kids," he murmured sadly. The pilot of the Fokker pulled up and soared over the arched cables of the bridge with only feet to spare. Then he dove ahead to pick up additional speed and made a 180-degree turn, flying head-on toward the trimotor. Rather than wait to be shot at like a tin can on a rock, Pitt stood the trimotor on its port wingtip and sent the aircraft on the sharpest turn possible, heading directly over Piers 11 and 13 and crossing the FDR Drive and South Street at a 90-degree angle. He flattened out as he soared less than 200 feet above Wall Street and swooped over the statue of George Washington taking the oath of office, the roar from the exhaust of the Pratt Whitney echoing off the buildings and vibrating their windows. The 77-foot, 10-inch wingspan barely cleared the fronts of the buildings as he struggled to climb out of the glass and concrete canyon. Mary sat in shock, blood trickling down one cheek cut by a flying shard of glass. "This is madness." Sorry, Pitt said flatly. I don't have a wide range of choices. Pitt pulled back the control column as he saw what looked to be a wide street that turned out to be the lower reach of Broadway. With only a few feet to spare, he made a sharp bank and swept up the famous thoroughfare only a block from the New York Stock Exchange, past St. Paul's Chapel and across from City Hall Park. Police cars with sirens attempted to follow in the path of the airplane, but it was no contest. They could not make their way through traffic at half the same speed. The pilot of the Red Fokker temporarily lost Pitt in the jungle of buildings. He circled over the East River before climbing to 1,000 feet and heading over Lower Manhattan. He passed above the tall ships at the South Street seaport and leaned from the cockpit, trying to locate the trimotor again. And then he caught a flash of silver that reflected in the sun. He raised his goggles and stared, disbelieving, at the trimotor flying below the tops of the buildings up Broadway. Pitt knew he was endangering lives, knew that having the Red Fokker send him down in flames along with the children was also jeopardizing the people below on the streets and sidewalks. His only hope was to elude his nemesis long enough to gain a substantial lead and wing out of the city, leaving the crazed Fokker pilot to deal with police helicopters. He became fixed in his dedication to save the children as he heard their voices singing. This old man, he play four. He play knick-knack on my door. With a knick-knack, paddywhack, give the dog a bone. This old man came rolling home. Suddenly, he saw the pavement below the tri-motor explode in a spray of asphalt as the Red Fokker swung onto his tail and unleashed a burst of 762 shells. The shells carved their way through the hood of a yellow taxicab and into a mailbox on the corner without hitting anyone. At first, Pitt thought the tri-motor had escaped unscathed, but then he felt a noticeable lack of response in the controls. A quick check revealed that the rudder was sluggish and the elevators refused to respond. Only the ailerons still functioned normally. Pitt realized that a bullet must have struck either the pulleys or their mountings to the control cables that traveled from the cockpit to the rudder and elevators on the exterior of the fuselage. "What's wrong?" asked Mary. "The last burst caught our elevators. I can't pull her into a climb." The Fokker's approach had been near perfect, but the sight of buildings rising above his wings unhinged him, and he overshot the tri-motor before his guns could do any fatal damage. The pilot pulled up in a sharp vertical climb and performed an Immelmann maneuver by entering a roll and coming out flying in the opposite direction. It was immediately apparent to Pitt that his opponent was not going to waste time with a frontal assault. He was content to come up from the rear and attack from behind the tri-motor's big tail section. "Can you keep him in sight?" Pitt asked Mary. "Not when he's directly behind," she said calmly. She loosened her seatbelt so she could twist around in her seat. "I'll lean out as far as I can and watch our tail."
"Good girl." Kelly appeared in the doorway.
"The children are incredible. They're taking it in stride."
"Because they don't know we're on borrowed time."
Pitt glanced down and guessed that they were flying through Greenwich Village. Then they flashed over Union Square Park. He could see Times Square approaching ahead. He knew the theater district was only a block off to his left. The lights from the huge signs flashed past as he flew over the statue of George M. Cohan. He tried to pull the plane higher to rise from the city, but the elevator controls refused to respond. For the moment, all Pitt could do was maintain a straight and level flight. He was all right as long as Broadway was angling slightly to the west, but when it took a slight dogleg at 48th Street near Paramount Plaza, he knew he was in trouble. There was no feel to the elevators, and he had to push the pedals with all his strength to get the slightest response from the rudder. The ailerons were all he had, but the slightest miscalculation, the tiniest twitch of the control wheel, would send the plane smashing into the side of a building. He was reduced to maintaining a straight course up Broadway by orchestrating the throttles. Pitt was sweating freely, and his lips were dry. The sheer walls of New York City's buildings seemed close enough for him to reach through the side window and touch. The street ahead looked endless, and he felt as if it were closing in and becoming narrower. The crowds of people on the sidewalks and crossing the intersections stood dumbstruck at seeing the tri-motor flying down the middle of Broadway, only 10 stories above the pavement. The roar of the two engines was deafening, and they could hear it coming blocks away. Office workers, who looked down at the plane from their windows as it roared past, were frozen in disbelief at the bizarre sight. All who watched the tri-motor's progress thought it was about to crash. Pitt tried desperately to bring the nose up, but it simply would not rise. He throttled back to reduce the speed to a bare 70 miles an hour, only 6 miles an hour above stalling. The pilot of the Red Fokker was a good flyer and skilled as a fox stalking a chicken. Pitt was in a battle that took every ounce of pure courage or fearless defiance. This was a conflict between two men of equal skill and technique, of patience and tenacity. He was not merely fighting for his life, but the lives of 2 women and 15 disabled children, and God only knew how many would die if the tri-motor fell and exploded on the crowded streets of the city. Behind him, the children were beginning to feel the first tentacles of fear at seeing the buildings so close to their windows, and yet they still managed to sing, urged on by Kelly, who was too frightened to look outside at the blur of passing office buildings and see the faces of stunned workers behind the glass windows. At 1,000 feet, the pilot of the Fokker gazed down at the tri-motor threading its way between the stores and buildings of Broadway. His was the patience of the devil waiting for the soul of an honorable man. He did not feel the need to dive and strafe the old transport again just yet. There was every likelihood it would crash on its own. He watched with fascination as a police helicopter appeared and took up the chase, flying at an altitude just above the rooftops between the Fokker and the Ford. Cool and precise, he eased the control stick forward, nosing the Fokker into a dive directly toward the helicopter. A policeman on board who had kept an eye on the Red Fokker could be seen frantically shouting and pointing upward to the pilot. The helicopter swung to meet what they assumed was the onslaught, but the hand weapons carried by the crew were no match for the rapid-fire machine guns, whose bullets spat from the twin muzzles and smashed into the engine below the rotor. The attack was executed with single-minded viciousness and savagery. The burst of gunfire lasted no more than 3 seconds, but they were 3 seconds that transformed the helicopter from a sleek flying machine into a shredded, falling wreck that dropped onto the roof of an office building. Several people on the sidewalks were lacerated by flying debris, but incredibly, none was seriously injured, nor were any killed. The 2 policemen, pulled from the wreckage by building maintenance employees, suffered a few broken bones, but nothing that was life-threatening. It was inhuman. Inhuman action that served no earthly purpose. The pilot of the Fokker could just as easily have broken off the chase when he felt assured the tri-motor had only seconds to remain in the air. His sole reason for shooting down the police helicopter was not self-preservation. It was a cold-blooded act of pure enjoyment. He hardly glanced back at the destruction before taking up the pursuit of the tri-motor again. Pitt was not aware of the catastrophe in the wake of his aircraft. Mary, looking back through the cockpit side window, saw it, but she was frozen into silence. The street was making a slight curve, and he compressed his concentration to jockey the plane into a turn. Broadway angled left as it crossed Columbus Circle. He gave the right rudder a hard kick and slewed the plane around to the right as it broke free of the long chasm of tall buildings. His left wingtip missed the 70-foot-high statue of Christopher Columbus by less than 10 feet as he banked over Central Park West and 59th Street. At the southwest entrance to Central Park, he dodged around the monument to the victims of the battleship Maine and headed out over the park. Riders on the bridle path struggled to stay in the saddle as their horses reared when the tri-motor roared overhead. Thousands of people who were enjoying the park on a warm summer afternoon stopped their activities and stared at the drama unfolding above them. Police cars from all over the city were converging on the park, sirens screeching. More police helicopters were sweeping into the park from Fifth Avenue, accompanied by a squadron of helicopters from the television channels. "He's coming back," Mary shouted. "He's 800 feet above and diving on our tail." Pitt could bank and barely turn, but he couldn't gain a foot of altitude without the elevators that were shredded with bullet holes and frozen in the neutral position. A plan formed in his mind, a plan that would only work if the Red Fokker made a strafing run directly over the tri-motor and then overshot. He reached over and flicked the ignition and fuel switches of the middle engine to the on position. The battered engine coughed several times, then caught and began turning over. Then he banked the tri-motor sharply to the right, knowing his insane attacker was thundering in from above. The evasive action momentarily caught the pilot off his mark, and the twin streams of fire from the Red Fokker went wide to the left. The old transport was no match for the maneuverability of the tri-wing plane, flown with great success by Imperial Germany's finest pilots 80 years ago. The Fokker's pilot quickly compensated, and Pitt felt the thumping of bullets tearing into the upper wing of the tri-motor and ripping into the starboard engine. Flames erupted inside the nacelle behind the engine, but its cylinders still beat strongly. He twisted the old plane in the opposite direction, waiting with infinite patience for the right moment to go on the attack. Suddenly, a storm of bullets swept the cockpit, smashing into the instrument panel. The mad pilot was anticipating Pitt's every move. The man was cunning, but it was Pitt's turn as the Red Fokker flashed over the shattered windshield and roared ahead. Pitt shoved all three throttles to their stops. With two engines, his speed matched that of the Fokker, but with his center engine throwing out clouds of smoke and oil but running on all cylinders, the tri-motor leaped forward like a thoroughbred out of the chute. His face streaking blood from windshield glass that had been hurled into his cheeks and forehead, splattered with oil and barely able to see through the smoke, Pitt shouted out in glorious defiance, "Curse you, Red Baron!" Too late, the leather-helmeted head in the red cockpit spun around and saw the silver tri-motor boring through the air within 20 feet. He hurled the Fokker into a violent bank, flipping it on its wingtips. It was the wrong move. Pitt had outguessed him. If he'd pulled up in a steep climb, the tri-motor would have been helpless to follow, not with the damaged elevators. But on a 90-degree angle with its three starboard wings rising toward the sky, the Red Fokker was vulnerable. One of the tri-motor's big landing wheels smashed through the wood and fabric, shattering and splintering the upper wing into shreds. Pitt only had time for one brief glimpse of the pilot as the Fokker catapulted crazily in an out-of-control spin. In a show of unabashed audacity, he shook his fist at Pitt. Then Pitt lost sight of the red plane as it spun and crashed into the trees around the Shakespearean Gardens. The wooden propeller splintered into 100 pieces as it struck the trunk of a large elm. The fuselage and wings crumpled like a boy's model airplane made from balsa wood, tissue paper, and glue. Within minutes, the wreckage was surrounded by police cars, their red and blue lights flashing like colored lightning strikes. With fortitude he didn't believe possible, Kelly was still leading the children in song as the battered aircraft struggled to stay aloft. "This old man, he play 10. He play knick-knack on my hen." Pitt shut down the center and the starboard engines before they turned the tri-motor into a torch. Like a badly wounded warhorse that never faltered in charging forward, the old bird fought to claw the air. Streaming smoke and flame, her one good engine racing at full RPM, Pitt made a flat circle and aimed the plane toward the largest open space in sight, a large grassy area known as the Sheep Meadow. Hordes of people who were picnicking or laying in the sun, tanning, suddenly began scattering like ants when they saw the bullet-riddled aircraft losing altitude and coming their way. They didn't need an illustration to realize the plane might crash and burn in their midst. Leaning out the side window to avoid the smoke flooding the cockpit, Pitt squinted at the green field and lined up for a landing. Under normal circumstances, he knew he could land her on a quarter and give a dime for change, but with almost no control, all bets were off. He eased back on the throttle and slowly dropped her toward the grass. 2,000 people stood in shocked silence, many praying the badly damaged plane, engulfed by smoke and flame, could somehow land safely without exploding on impact. Breaths were held, fingers crossed. They gazed fascinated and listened to the howling roar of the one engine running at full RPM. They stared and stared, numb with anticipation, fear, and disbelief as it brushed through the tops of the trees on the edge of the meadow. Years later, none who witnessed the incredible sight could describe it accurately. Their memory became hazy, trying to recall the sight of the ancient aircraft lumbering toward the grassy field. In the main cabin, the children were singing the final chorus. This old man came rolling home. The plane wavered as Pitt sideslipped it. Then it seemed to hang for a moment before the big wheels met the grass, bounced twice, and then the plane was down, the tail wheel dropping to the ground. To everybody's amazement, the tri-motor rolled to a stop in less than 50 yards. None who watched believed it possible. Seeing the crowd pour toward the airplane, Pitt cut the remaining engine, watching its propeller come to a stop, the blade stopping in a vertical position. He turned to Mary and started to say something, to compliment her on her intrepid assistance. But he remained silent when he saw her face, drained of all color. He reached out and put his fingers against her neck, feeling for a pulse. Then his hand dropped and clenched. Kelly leaned breathlessly into the cockpit. "You did it," she burst happily. "The children?" Pitt asked in a distant voice. "All unharmed." Then she saw the back of Mary's co-pilot seat, the almost perfectly spaced pattern of small holes punched by the spandaus of the Fokker. Kelly stood absolutely still in shock as Pitt solemnly shook his head. At first, she refused to believe Mary was gone, her friend of many years dead. But she looked down and saw the expanding pool of blood on the cockpit floor and realized the awful truth. Deep sorrow brushed her face, matched by the confusion in her eyes. "Why?" she murmured vacantly. "Why did this have to happen? There was no reason for Mary to die." People came from all over the nearby streets and park to look at the peppered old aircraft and marvel. Thousands were shouting and waving at the cockpit. But to Pitt, it was as if they were not visible and they could not be heard. He felt surrounded not by the people, but by the futility of it all. He looked at Kelly and he said she wasn't the only one killed by the man who flew that plane. There were many others who needlessly lost their lives. "It's all so stupid," murmured Kelly, through hands covering her face as she sobbed. "Cerberus," Pitt said quietly, barely audible above the cheering outside. "Someone, I don't know who yet, is going to Hades to meet him."